listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In his new and startlingly original book, The Anatomy of Harpo Marx, Wayne Kestenbaum quotes the philosopher Wittgenstein, who suggests that what can't be discussed should be left unmentioned. Kestenbaum's observations of Harpo Marx contradict this approach. He says what can't be discussed should be turned into comedy. Harpo makes comedy out of everything. Harpo, Kestenbaum reminds us, is a one-man antidote to the concept of censorship, and thus, I might add, a perfect subject for the library. He declares everything is in bounds. That could also be the motto of Wayne Kestenbaum's book, which is digressive at the core, a playful, personal take on a silent actor who, quote, valued detours. The author explains that he engages in what he calls, quote, double speaking. Speaking about Harpo, and then speaking about Harpo. And it is those aspects of Harpo Marx, the unspeaking Marx brother, that Kestenbaum addresses. His body, his butt, his laugh, his frozen eyes, his drooping drawers, the way he eats, and the way he sleeps. Wayne Kestenbaum, in short, is obsessed with Harpo, and that is in keeping with his own distinguished body of work, the most trenchant of which, as David Ulan noted in the LA Times, quote, explore the connections between our obsessions and how we live. Wayne Kestenbaum is a poet, essayist, and social critic. He's a distinguished professor of English at New York City University of New York Graduate Center and a visiting professor at the Yale School of Art. He's written a dozen or so books of poetry and nonfiction, including an examination of opera and gay culture in his book, The Queen's Throat. And in Jackie Under My Skin, he deconstructed the role of Jackie Onassis as the object of a collective fantasy. Now, Harpo Marx is the subject of his scrutiny, his obsession, and his insightful, sometimes transgressive observations. We'll watch Harpo in action on some film clips, and Wayne will be joined by Matthias Wigner, an ever-inventive artist, author, and critic who is one of the founders of the art collective Fallen Fruit, which has exhibited, I'm sure you've seen their work, at LACMA, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. They've shown internationally in Mexico, Colombia, Denmark, Austria, and Spain. Matthias teaches at CalArts, and he writes regularly on art for a number of journals. He is co-editor of Seance in Experimental Writing and the Nolipian Analects, and his book, 2500 Random Things About Me, is due out in June from Les Figues Press. Please join me in welcoming Wayne Kestenbaum and Matthias Wigner.
Thank you. You go, baby.
Okay. Enjoy.
Yeah. Break a leg.
Hello, people. Happy
Hi.
To see you. Very happy to be here to celebrate Harpo Marx's transgressiveness, beauty, provocativeness, and very happy to be here with Matthias.
Same. Happy to be here.
So we're going to start with a film clip. It's about 5 minutes long. It's from the film Horse Feathers, which is 1932. So it's early in history, early in the Marx Brothers film career. And it's a scene of bullying. So let's watch it.
All right, Wayne. Let's do as the clip does and get tough.
Okay.
yeah, thinking we would just be nerdy and intellectual. Yeah. I want to talk. I'd like you to start talking about the bullying, right? Which actually starts out with them intending to be bullies and, of course, not being so. And maybe the transformation from male to neuter and even female. This is, by the way, the image on the cover of Wayne's book. Mm-hmm.
An image that when people see it first, they think it's Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. A little bit, you know. The funny thing about Harpo is that he is ever ready to be bullied. He's just this sort of walking tissue of vulnerability. But whether it's some violent core in him or his willingness to turn rules upside down, he can always surmount the bully. He's shame-proof in a funny way. What's, I think, cathartic about watching this scene is even though his sadness at the end seems real, and it's actually a kind of a scene of semi-tragic scapegoating, if you take it seriously, that he is able to undergo the charade of scapegoating without letting it actually touch his interior. He's completely immune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's his interiority, which you talk about in the book, is inaccessible to us, right?
Yeah.
It's all surfaces. And a lot of it is sort of framed through his muteness, which comes up here. And his muteness combined with his misunderstanding of language, right?
Yes.
Which the others do too, but he's mm-hmm. he's really the key brother of misunderstanding.
Yep.
So perhaps you could say something about the relationship between the muteness and language. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite sound bites from your book is language sickens him.
Uh-huh. He's often there are scenes where particularly Groucho or Margaret Dumont are indulging in excess rhetoric, and Harpo looks literally sickened by language's embroidery, language as an unnecessary addendum to pure experience. He also, though, he seems to be the minder or babysitter of other people's language. He's the dismemberer of language, but he's in some weird way the silent sharer in and the tender of language. So I think that when he misreads Chico's words by taking them literally, in a funny way, he is paying a kind of poetic homage to that word. He's sequestering it from its family of mm-hmm. common meanings, and he's holding it almost on a silver plate and taking it elsewhere. There's something deliberate, sacramental, quiet, and mm-hmm. not merely foolish about his dismemberment and taking literally of other people's
poetics,
words.
Right? Pick, pig, hog, hug.
Yeah. And he's pleased. He's doing it to please Chico. And that for him, the crucial moment is not just the getting the word wrong, but assessing whether Chico was pleased by it. And Chico will never be pleased by that. But it's really, I would say, I mean, the thing that makes the thing that is to me the core of the scene and that needs to be said most is that it is Chico's tenderness toward Harpo that holds us together, and it is Harpo's unswerving, foundationless loyalty to Chico as his god.
Mm-hmm. The brother theme comes up continually in each chapter of the book, right? Mm-hmm. And it has a bit of a relation to your sense of brothers and brotherliness. Perhaps you could talk about. We've only had seen the two of them, and we'll see more later.
Yeah, I have
clan.
Two brothers. Mm-hmm. One doesn't need to have a brother to understand what it is, what brothers mean in culture. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think Freud, for one, made a lot of stink out of fathers and mothers and babies. He was smart to do so, mm-hmm. but maybe not enough about brothers. And it was actually Freud's brother or half-brother who dominated his consciousness. So I think that the relation of envy, closeness, tenderness, rivalry, hatred mm-hmm. between brothers is a vivid part of culture. And I feel it I feel it mostly particularly in Harpo's tactile relationship to Chico's body and coat. That he seems to want to mm-hmm. be tethered to reality by grabbing hold of the steerage.
Almost maternal connection to Chico's coat.
Yeah.
They are in another version of Freud, they are a kind of primal horde, the way you find in Moses and monotheism, right? Where it all depends on the father being dead, and sometimes Groucho is the father, but mostly they are the horde, right?
Yeah.
And they exist among themselves.
And it's clearest when Groucho is gone, Chico and Harpo have more fun. Yeah. They are more horde-like.
But they are the two more fun ones, right?
Yeah. No, I like what's also, my book makes its very literary and interpretive. I try to make as much of Harpo's gestures and actions as possible. But what's beautiful about actually seeing the clip is how lightly these meanings are worn, and how I think of it like Andy Warhol's silver pillows floating out the window when he said he was going to quit painting, that the themes effervesce and like bubbles vanish, even though the time in which these films was made is a tragic time. Mm-hmm. And the bubbles seem not to run into the tragedy or be pierced by the tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're made in the Depression.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them. Let's maybe talk about the gender, right? These sort mm-hmm. of two all-American guys who they're supposed to control, who of course can't be controlled in there. Their relationship of as immigrants and as Jews, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. and a lot of what jumps out, it's not the subject of your book to me, but is Chico's kind of Italian accent rather than a Jewish sounding New York accent.
Right. I mean, I'm totally charmed by Chico's Italian accent, even though I suppose some people could think it's offensive or something, but it has its own tenderness. I'm aware in that scene when they're the two, I guess they're Irish guys, and then mm-hmm. there's Chico and Harpo, how small and vulnerable and about to be persecuted their bodies are. I mean, I identify so much with their small mm-hmm. bodies, but resilient too. They also seem to have,
scrappy.
Chico particularly with his kind of masculine ladies' man swagger, and Harpo with his just adorability. They seem to conquer their smallness, but they dwell within their bodies in a way that I find not merely about smallness, but about the homesteading. They seem mm-hmm. to, their center of gravity, I'm moved by that.
Mm-hmm. Muteness and cuteness.
Muteness and cuteness. I really think, I mean, the thing about Harpo is that he is cute, and cuteness is something, you know, we have beauty as a major theme. We have power, beauty, aggression. There are like the large cultural themes that have been dealt with, but cuteness falls between the cracks.
Mm-hmm. It's also not necessarily true, right?
Yeah.
Beauty, power, truth, and it's neither true nor false, it just is.
And it's also with Harpo, if you think about the gender of Harpo, Harpo is at once absolutely a man and very, but he's plastic within his maleness, and he goes baby and girl and mm-hmm. The wig. I mean, he's genderless. He's genderless without anxiety from a very solid point in the universe. He gives androgyny. He makes androgyny seem fun.
Mm-hmm. The calendar. What about the calendar? The pin-up calendar.
I love the moment that he not only pins it up. I think it's again the homesteading impulse that he feels it's necessary in this strange. Mm-hmm. He's left the shtetl and now he's wherever he is, Kansas, mm-hmm. the Lower East Side. He has to put up his calendar to know what time, in a way, to get in touch with the household gods of his past, this kind of, goddess of grain or whoever she is, but that he looks behind the calendar to see what, and I think of it, he's looking into time's anteriority. What's behind time? Nothing. But that doesn't upset Harpo.
It's comforting.
Yeah, it's comforting, but he does it, one could call it an obsessive mm-hmm. Gesture of averting disaster by, it's a fetishistic ritual.
Right, and the other aversion of disaster is when he turns the calendar around so the girl doesn't see his brother in his underwear.
Yeah, yeah, which is very old world. And of course, with also the adorable thing about Harpo is his simple-mindedness. He does not understand the great chain of being. Everything is equal for him.
Right, images and people.
Yeah.
He's an image-based man.
Are we on to the next clip? Let's go to the next clip.
Clip number two.
We're going to now see the puppet. We're going to see two clips from Monkey Business. First, Harpo loitering outside the men or women's room. Then a little interlude with Zeppo, the cute, the conventionally handsome matinee idol brother, and then a scene in a puppet theater. So here goes with the next clip.
Mm-hmm.
So in this clip, there's a movement, right? It really shows Harpo's physical comedic skills. And there's a movement from his being a clown to being a puppet to being a punching bag, which you talk about. And I'm wondering, Wayne, were you picked on as a child?
Well, yeah. I mean, I am interested in bullying. And I wrote this book before I wrote a book that came out last year, Humiliation. And I was even thinking of calling this book Harpo's Humiliation because it's sort of the leitmotif. I don't think, picked on in a way that was more than many kids, I think. But yeah, I was picked on a little. I was always the smallest boy. Always. I grew up in California, in San Jose, California, and it seemed it was just like a sea of tall people. I was also the only Jew in my neighborhood school, or so it seemed. The other ones were in hiding. And so I always thought, I mean, you don't even need to know this, but it is why I was drawn to write about this book. I always thought that having curly hair, being a shrimp, and being a Jew were primal stigmas in some way. I also had a good time. You know, this isn't a tragic story, but I think that I identify with Harpo's transmutation of those qualities into joy, levity, resistance, really a kind of anarchic re-legislation of the rules of society. And particularly, I think you talk about his physical comedy. You're so right. It's every part of his body is separable from the others. Mm-hmm. Particularly the butt.
Mm-hmm. Particularly the butt. In the opening of that clip, right, he's doing a piece of physical comedy that he doesn't even seem to know that he's doing, yeah. Right, by standing in front of the W.O.,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But do you think he's cruising?
Well, it is a fun... I love that scene, given that my my work is, you know, very much about queer culture. It, you know, seen from my eye, looked at that way, or even within the kind of the culture of homosexual innuendo in early pre-code films that Vito Russo's classic account, The Celluloid Closet, you know, exemplifies, that there's a kind of light innuendo there that he's looking for trouble of some unspecified kind, and then that gets neutralized, of course, when he immediately chases the girl. Yeah. Harpo's sexuality is really everywhere, and it's for that we celebrate him. But he's indifferent. I would say more than what's more important in a way, any specific sexual position he occupies is how linguistically merely his obdurate presence in front of the sign destabilizes and screws up the whole system, and that he doesn't care. He is indifferent to gender with a kind of placid equanimity.
Indifferent to gender and indifferent to language,
yeah,
right?
Both. They do not concern him.
Right.
Yeah. And indifferent to maturity. Mm-hmm. I mean, maturity is like a great repressive category. Grow up, you know. And again, to invoke Freud, I mean, it's the process of maturation and ego id integration where we, in a way, give up joy. And Harpo has a kind of lifelong franchise to play.
Yeah, he's plugged in.
Yeah.
He's plugged in. Let's talk maybe about the puppet show a little more. And, you know, one of the things you talk about is his relation to, it's not just muteness, but his, you know, almost artistic puppet quality, right?
Yeah.
And like has been said since, you know, on Kleist in the 19th century, the puppet is this figure for us because they're both very, they seem so full because they're so empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Harpo, for you, has that same...
I don't know why. It's so true. I don't know why I love Harpo's emptiness more than I love his joy. It's the scenes of when he goes... It's particularly with Chico or he's required to do a bit of adult business of some kind, which means understand a sentence, deliver some goods, participate in the social exchange. And he responds to that by abstaining and just his face goes completely dead and kind of stupid, but that seems like a zone of paradisaical exile, like Walden Pond. I really think it's, or like Bartleby saying, I, you know, prefer not to, or whatever he says. It's a really staunch American resistance to productivity.
He's a slacker.
Yeah, he's a slacker. Yeah. But it is, I mean, we court the specter here of autism or of a real inability to be nourished by other people that gives a sense of a hauntedness to those moments. It's not just paradise.
Mm-hmm.
It's ejection from reciprocity. It's being abandoned, really.
Right, right. There aren't that many reciprocal relationships in his life.
No, the horn.
Yep.
His objects. He has a family of objects, mm-hmm. and the shtick itself is an object that he holds.
Mm-hmm. And even the brothers, right?
Yeah.
It's not quite reciprocal. The other thing that I was going to talk about here, it appears in every clip with him, but and you talk about it a lot, is his way of looking in the middle ground, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't look at the camera, although he does in key moments, he does, but he has that third place that his eyes go,
yeah.
right? Which isn't where anyone else's eyes go.
Yeah, he does. His eyes are very undisciplined with regard to the camera. First of all, particularly in early films, he looks directly at the camera, which you're not supposed to do, but he suddenly says, I know you're there. And he looks at the camera, and then he goes into this zone that is not the other. It's as if instead of talking to you,
right.
Matthias, or looking at you, I find a sliver of, I think of it as a sliver of indeterminateness or in-betweenness that is his, you could call it his, literally his safe space, but it's also, it's his kingdom. And I think he has a kind of magisterial authority there. I think of him, I mean, I read him as a poet in a way, or it, you know, a poet of silence, but that he, when he revisits that kingdom of the interstitial, he's going there not just to goof off, but to be king and to be sovereign of something separate from the policing of interaction.
Mm-hmm.
This may not be true, but I believe it fiercely.
Yeah. No, I was going to talk about it a little later, but there's a lot of, it's a good moment, because in some sense you're not particularly concerned with the truth value of your statements, just sort of the grammar, the sentence that lets you get there. Right.
I know it is true, and I try to be very open about that I'm not in pursuit of the truth of Harpo, but I think that I have I identify with Harpo, and I want to locate what seems to me an emotional truth of the image, and that I never lie. I don't make up something for effect. I only write something if it seems to me bedrock truth. But it's only true for that moment. And again, like the bubble, it goes. You could say Harpo is labile. His moods shift, and the truth of Harpo shifts, too.
Yeah, like la donna è mobile.
Yeah, he is. I mean, that's his trickster identity, but he doesn't. And because he can never speak and say, I'm Harpo, there's never any. He never has to sign his name to any permanent state of being. And I also have to say that the moment that moves me most in that first clip is when Chico says Pinky. And he keeps on reiterating Pinky. That's his name, Pinky.
Harpo's name.
Yeah, Harpo's name, Pinky. Hey, Pinky, do this. And every time it's as that there is a that is Harpo's moment of the solidity of being identified. That is the moment when he achieves a momentary citizenship. You're Pinky, but you're only going to be Pinky for the space of this film, and only the moment that Chico says Pinky. I don't know what when he says Pinky, I feel that the universe clicks into place.
Mm-hmm. And Pinky, you talk about, is that body part, because he's often his parts, not his whole unified being, right?
Yeah.
But and it also has that echo of Pinko,
yeah.
right? And they often play on that, our expectation that they would be communists somehow.
And there's also the Pinking Shears. His father was a tailor, and Harpo has his own relationship to scissors. And, you know, yeah, pink. One could go very far into pink in understanding the meaning of Harpo.
Mm-hmm. His hominess, there's some relationship which you write about in the between the sort of aspects of abjection that he demonstrates, but they're always tempered with safety, right?
Yeah.
Like it never, it doesn't go into the abject space. It becomes a very happy, safe, contained space.
So that even the moment when he is about to be dismembered by the ship's captain in the puppet mm-hmm. scene, his leg is being pulled, he immediately leaves the proscenium and he has a kind of a buddy-like physical relationship mm-hmm. with the two policemen. They're essentially policemen.
Right.
He immediately finds enclosure, connectiveness, tactility, but again, only for a moment.
And he finds it, but also gives up his leg symbolically,
yeah.
right? He lets them have it.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we should see the next clip. Does that
Go
seem
for it. Yeah.
sane? Okay. The next clip is from Animal Crackers, and it's Harpo with Margaret Irving. Not Margaret Dumont, but Margaret Irving, whom I say in the book reminds me of a cross between Amelia Earhart and Rosalind Russell.
So this is probably a good place to start talking about gender, which is a key part of your book, a key part of what you do in life. As you point out, and I think as we see, one of the ways he gets around, there are two basic ways, at least two. One way that he gets around gender is by being a child, an ungendered child, and the other way is via animals, right, mm-hmm. by being an animal. And he kind of both are combined here. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's funny. When he's, how old are you? It's not clear that one way to read that is that he is 5 years old, but another simple way is that he wants to stump her and mm-hmm. confound the very question. And there's another moment in one of the films where I refer to his menorah fingers in some sense, and that there is almost like a kind of, he's presenting some holy code that's beyond her system. He goes between baby and lech. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not lech, except for when he's chasing the girl. When he chases the girl, we're in the realm of Swan Lake and paradise and very magical, mystical themes. But when he's wanting to colonize her body by kind of crawl on it, it's not, one can't say it's exactly sexual desire, but a kind of hunger for property.
See, it's like monkey desire.
Yeah, yeah, it's a sense that this limb could also get value here, so it should be placed. There's a maximizing of spatial relations. Mm-hmm. I find it a very poignant scene, though, when he brings forward the horse as his object of desire.
Yeah, and then her giggling, her sort yeah. of almost uncontrollable giggling, which turns out to be staged, but...
But it's cruel. It feels oh, yeah. that because there is a moment, that's Harpo's, Harpo is being very true there. Do you love somebody, and he says yes, and then he takes that from his world is his pocket, and everything is contained, and he takes out from his pocket, which is like steerage, this card, and it's not clear whether he loves the horse, whether he loves horses in general, whether he loves flashcards, whether he loves images or alphabets or just the toy that defers the affront of her demand.
Mm-hmm.
But then when she laughs at it, I feel that his entire system is shattered. He is, some psychoanalysts would say that that's a moment where identity gets spoiled. Mm-hmm. In one minute, mm-hmm. the delicate edifice of his ego is mm-hmm. radically
and then
spoiled.
And he's etherized, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He, in this scene, as you talked about, there's a way in which he really understands the structure of gender and heterosexuality, right? Yeah. Just as he does with language, but he mm-hmm. also utterly refuses to enter it.
Through a kind of chasteness, like mm-hmm. when he hits her hand, don't do that. It's like when he turns the calendar over, Chico can't be nude, can't, or whatever, undressed, can't be seen by the woman. There's a sense of old-fashioned manners and duenna propriety that he's... Mm-hmm. But it's a severity, a severe acknowledgement that does not apply to him. That language of demand, because she wants something at him. She's actually a crook in the plot of the film. She doesn't want his body or his soul. She wants something out of him, and he understands that he is being molested in some way on the park bench. It's a creepy scene mm-hmm. in a way. I mean, it is. If you take him literally to be 5 years old or some kind of strange changeling. a damaged goods.
Mm-hmm. A haunted
child. But he recovers, and he has his lollipop.
Which leads to another scene that you talk about a lot, which is a kind of seduction body scene that ends up much in the same way as this. Nowhere.
Yeah. The lollipop, I refer to it in the book as like Keats's Grecian urn, where the figures are forever dancing and they're never moving, and that Harpo's lollipop is always being licked, but it will never be received or eaten. And I say also, who really even likes lollipops? It's not a real treat.
The papers in the beginning, they tie into something you talk about a lot, which is he won't relinquish the papers, right? And he has a relationship, a different relationship with written language, right? And especially with letters, right? Mm-hmm. He's always destroying letters, withholding them, taking them, you know. That seems to be a key part of your understanding of him.
Yeah, I think it's not just that he is immune to language or indifferent to it, but one could say his mission is to destroy it. The very first scene in his film career, in The Coconuts, he is virtually the first thing he does is he's ripping up letters at a hotel desk. The second the letters arrive, he rips them up even before putting them in the mail slots. And he's figured out like a new system of communication. It's intercept the communication before it even arrives. And that there is there's something radically annihilating actually about the totality of his ambition to just mercilessly remove the middleman of language. It does not, Harpo says, I ban language from my kingdom. And you shall not have language either because I have refused it. He's a bit of a dictator, like all babies.
Like all babies. Captain. Yeah. He's a captain baby.
Yeah.
He likes the physics. He likes the papers and he likes the letters, right? He likes the materiality of language in some way, just not what it does to, what it's trying to do to him or does to us.
Yeah, he has a sense of, he wishes to maximize the number of possessions. He wants, in a way, wants to be a middleman through whom as many goods pass as possible. He's consoled by that.
He likes stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about his relationship
with stuff.
He's a hobo,
essentially, because the question is, where did they live? Chico, Groucho is his own thing. Groucho has his own domicile in the joke and in language, and he has a way into high society. He's just about there.
He passes.
Yeah, he passes. Zeppo is adorable. Zeppo is also on a totally other page. Chico and Harpo are immigrants. They are lower class immigrants who are ejected from any decent, you know, American home within the kind of the high society precincts of these films. And Harpo particularly one has a sense that he has a home off camera. Where he's always in a way sleep deprived, so he can't get too much sleep in his little pleasure shack.
Right, sleep deprived and pockets. You talk about his pockets a lot and his endless capacity not just to take things but to produce things out of his pockets and bags.
And I think if you think of it anatomically, because the book is called The Anatomy of Harpo Marx, and my instinct is to make plural Harpo's anatomy and not to say his pockets. He has a lot of holes. He has a lot of sequestered places. There's an endlessness to Harpo's maw. Harpo, it's in. Any scene where he's eating, he doesn't just have one bite. It's in. There's a greediness and orality, but also a kind of utopic promise that maybe the body holds more than we think it does, and maybe particularly the male body is more porous and flexible and unmapped than we thought.
Polysemic. Right. The anatomy. So you really begin in a way by focusing on his body and kind of as a body of parts, right?
Yeah.
Not a unified body. And your text, your structure of the book, it sort of limbs that, right? So it's organized in chapters, which are the 12 films they made together, the first 12 films. But within the chapter, it's really a collection of fragments.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you did that deliberately. There's no coincidences.
And this is partly, as you see, even like in these scenes, Harpo enters and exits. Harpo, it's not, the films are not vehicles in which Harpo is a point of continuous interest. He's a visitor from afar, so that Harpo's actions are themselves composed of little bits of shtick developed through in vaudeville over the years, comedic tropes inherited from his precursors, mm-hmm. and that he's assembled Harpo through bits and pieces of business that have worked in vaudeville. So Harpo is himself a grab bag of bits. And so my book is composed of bits. And I think that the bit philosophy of existence that vaudeville embodies presupposes a certain dismemberment, entropy, and sadness at how splayed and separated oneself is into these little pieces, a homelessness. On the other hand, Harpo, how intrepid and virtuoso Harpo is at sewing the bits back together into a recognizable self, a pinky, makes him a hero. Should we have time for one more brief clip, which is the end of Animal Crackers. Would this be the time to talk about fascism?
Sure.
Because I know you had mentioned to me when we spoke earlier that that was something that you wanted to discuss.
Especially in the chapter on duck soup, you have a way of the whole chapter is duck soup was made and came out in 1933, so it was made in 1932, right? Mm-hmm. And your basic interpretation of duck soup is that it is responding and commenting to fascism and the Holocaust, all of which hadn't really, it was just beginning to happen, but hadn't really happened for 10 years. And it's part of your kind of not just intellectual play, but your way of demonstrating the depth of what's going on, mm-hmm. right, in Harpo's presence and in his meaning, right, mm-hmm. and his kind of cultural role.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hear a cute little baby.
Oh.
Yeah, great. So the question is, I mean, the separate question of whether a work of art or it can predict something that hasn't yet happened, or whether there can be imminent in some a knowledge of something, or at least the potential for us to see backwards that these things were lurking in the wings. But I am, for example, it seems strange to say, but I'm haunted by the aspects of extermination project that haunt a lot of these films. It's obviously, I can't say it's intended. I can't even say that it's a major theme. It's a shadow. And it's a shadow that reveals itself in retrospect. But the question is, with the scenes of Harpo being policed or hounded out of town, why the zeal to put the whole population to sleep?
And then himself, because he doesn't really want to be alone.
Yeah, it's a suicide project that, of course, is dreamy and funny and gorgeous, and it happens very quickly. But if you're treating Harpo Marx with the utmost gravity and seriousness, as I do, as a crucial figure in 20th century performance and Jewish performance, the question is, you know, what is he bodying forth? And one of the questions of sleep, agency, exile,
home,
evacuation.
He has no home, right?
Yeah, and the question of where Harpo belongs, where do people want to put him, how will he retaliate, and what is this? It comes from German culture too. Tristan and Isolde. Mm-hmm. You could say, well, you know, Wagner didn't know about the Holocaust either, though. You could say that the themes of surrender to the nation and of being put to sleep by a love filter are Wagnerian themes that Harpo is summoning here in a pretty vivid way.
And Hitler himself, as you mentioned, he's loved the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. So it's again, you know, one is not talking about cause and effect. One is saying that when you read artifacts backwards and you happen to know the fullness of history, there's no sense in looking at these blindly.
Yeah, no sense. It makes no sense to ignore history.
Yeah. So I mean, the question is, why is it funny that Harpo wants to go dumb and empty and fall asleep. Why is it funny that Harpo wants to annihilate his own language? The question I ask that I think is the more somber question, why in fact is giving up language and giving up, why is it funny to have given up language? Why is the entire construction of Harpo is, one could think of as a kind of compromise or defense or a beautiful artwork created out of a situation that is in some way one of deprivation and sadness. Because the real Harpo, Arthur Marx, was refused an education. He left school because he was bullied in second grade, climbed out of the window and never returned. He put himself together from scratch and he gave up language very early in his performance career, but he did not begin as a mute. A critic.
He can talk.
Yeah, he can talk, and a critic criticized his voice. And he said, well, you know, I will stop speaking to further the comedy of the family act.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a sacrifice.
Family business.
A sacrificial economy underlies the art of Arthur Marx, whom we celebrate here tonight in L.A. as the genius he is.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely. No, really.
Perhaps we should open up to audience questions. Wow. We're gonna have to follow the mics. That's the.
Thank you for a most entertaining and informative evening. It seems that Harpo came along. Just as talking movies came along, and he seems like an enigma and maybe a throwback to the silent era, which had its own beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Harpo as anachronism and as Harpo who, I don't have much to say beyond that. I think absolutely Harpo is the presence of the past, and he is a kind of nagging or melancholy reminder of something that has an entire art and system of expressivity that was lost. But I would also say Charlie Chaplin and Fatty Arbuckle were important to me in my early film connoisseur life as a kid, and the sense of both of them as exiles and scapegoats underlies my affinity for Harpo.
The other way that the question's very useful is that a lot of what you're doing, an aspect of what you're doing is you're defining him as creating a poetics of silence and very much something that Wittgenstein opens the door for in poetry in a sense, right?
Yeah.
That there are things that can only be said through silence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious about, you haven't really mentioned the philosophy of clowning,
mm-hmm.
The idea that like there's a clown in everyone, and a lot of the like clowning classes are all about connecting with the audience, always staring ahead and looking at the audience and not saying a single word, and also always saying yes, which I'm surprised you haven't talked about how like Harpo always says yes to everything, and it's never really no, and if he says no, it's a yes, no. So I was curious about that. And also, I had a question, sorry, just a question about like him killing everyone at the end.
Yeah.
Just because it seems so odd to connect it to something that hasn't happened yet, but it seems so natural to just say that's the outcast of society that's just destroying society around him.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm curious about why you jumped ahead and why you didn't focus on just someone taking society down a peg and winning the day.
I think, one could say that as a writer, as somebody who's had a lot of other projects and that Harpo is, that for me, my concern is to speak of what I can of Harpo in terms of the themes that have preoccupied me and that I can speak most forcefully about. And so that I don't, my duty to Harpo, in a way, is to align him with what seem crucial issues of aesthetics and ethics in the 20th century. So that it's not, I'm not the only one who has such duties, but I feel that my duty as a writer is to give voice to a thing in Harpo that seems that needs to be said. About the clowning, I'm very aware, I think, and I say somewhere in the book that I give short shrift to Harpo's precursors and that I do not place him within the context, which would be fascinating to read about and to know about, of the entire tradition of comic acting and clowns, and that I take Harpo, in a sense, for my own purposes, as a kind of talisman, as an object that allows me to give voice to certain things. I hope to do him justice as well, but that I announce from the beginning of the book that my purpose is dual, to investigate what it means to talk about a silent man. Does it mean to obsessively talk about a man who gave up speech, and to think about that, and to almost imagine that Harpo is somebody who stumbled into my life. And what do I make of him? Why Harpo? Why has Harpo visited me in middle age? Why do I need to even... why has he visited me? So because it's a different point of view on
It's him. Not really your book. It's really The Anatomy of Wayne Kustenbaum by Harpo Marx.
Yeah, it's Harpo's book. Harpo wrote it. But it's also, I think, in terms of my other books that have been sort of biographies on Jackie Onassis, on opera, and particularly divas like Anna Maffo or Maria Callas, who lost their voices, Andy Warhol. I mean, and I've been interested in figures of charismatic voicelessness, charismatic, empty, magnetic voicelessness. So it's Harpo within that strange pantheon that's the Harpo in this book.
Thank you again for a great evening. How would Harpo's silence affect us without Groucho's volubility?
It's a big question, and it's the question of how the brothers, how their shticks fit together and add up to the total effect. And it is true that Harpo ironizes and mocks the surplus of Groucho's language, and Harpo's sweetness corrects the unkindness of the sometimes unkindness or snideness of Groucho, so that the brothers correct and compensate for each other. So it's an impossible thing to know, but I excerpt Harpo from the bunch and give him a soliloquy, and I say in the book early on that if Groucho doesn't want Harpo, if Harpo is the outcast tag along in the brothers, I'm giving Harpo his revenge by kicking the other brothers out and making him the star. So I'm not going to talk about the other brothers. Mm-hmm. It's on behalf of Harpo, I let him be the favorite in the family. In fact, I think the real biographies will tell you that Chico was the favorite of the mother.
You come back to Zeppo now and then.
I love. Well, I have a crush on Zeppo. Yeah. I think he's so sweet. He's so. Much could be said about Zeppo. Zeppo's nose. It's another book.
It's a fine nose. Yeah.
I was wondering whether you thought that Harpo's harp playing is his voice. You know, he walks away from his character. He never breaks the seriousness. When he's playing the harp, it is a totally different person. Is that how he speaks, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And the harp is his homeland. And the moments of harp playing are of the utmost seriousness. And it really, that may be Harpo, but it's also Arthur Marx there. And that's a rupture of the entire comedic principle. And they're very ghostly, strange, misfitting scenes. They don't belong. I didn't show one because in a way they're not entertaining. Mm-hmm. They're not funny. Harpo is seriously playing. He is speaking. He's exercising a kind of poetic virtuosity there. I find them very moving, and they are the bedrock of the films. But they're stumping.
You connect the harp playing with his Jewish soul.
Yeah, I do. I say in a way that he's the vehicle of romanticism, since the harp, Coleridge writes in the poem The Aeolian Harp, of the harp is a kind of a symbol of the creative soul of a human being, but because I think of the harp as his homeland, and because he gave his harp to Israel, the real Arthur Marx gave his harp when he died, he bequeathed it to Israel, there is some sense of the harp is his home. And it is like it's like he's singing the blues, but it's the Jewish blues.
Wavy Gravy, the countercultural clown, said a great clown is a poet who's also an orangutan, which is, you were talking about the poeticness of him. One of the Marx Brothers writers, Irving Brecker, wrote a couple movies for them. He said Harper was the easiest to write for. But don't you think at the end of that last scene, he gets the girl, and isn't that what Hollywood is all about?
Well, yeah, one could say, again, in the Wagnerian terms, that, like, Brynhilde got the guy, too. But at what cost, you know? A few catastrophes and falls of dynasties and a few countries wrecked. I guess that's a cynic's response. The microphone will find its destination.
A couple of things stood out for me in the presentation tonight. First, that scene from Horse Feathers, that first scene, I think is the only time I've ever seen Harpo Marx cry, and it was not played for comedy.
Right.
Also, through the course of every time I've seen him in a Marx Brothers movie, he never holds a grudge. Everything just kind of rolls off of him. How does that play into the character that he was?
He cries in, just to say something about, it's a complicated and beautiful question, to say something about the crying. He cries also in another film where he's in the classroom and he's humiliated. His tears can't be feigned in some way. I mean, they seem genuine. I agree with you. Like the harp playing, the moments of crying stand out as kind of raw, naked, verite, emblems of some kind of sadness or response to scapegoating that nothing else in the film can contain, and it just kind of pops out
in those moments. You talk about, it's also that he is really in the world. He may not be of the world, but he sees what's happening.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. Yes, very much.
Thank you, Matthias.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.